What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Happiness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show are four of the faculty members with whom I designed the Leadership Through Facilitation course, and we discussed the juicy topic of facipulation, whether we are using our facilitation skills to manipulate groups, and whether this makes us manipulators. So stay tuned and listen to this juicy conversation with Kate Schawinski, Florentin Bersteg, Shamir Joseph, Thomas Lahnthaler, and myself. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. And if you want to learn with us about leadership through facilitation, then visit the website neverdonebefore.org/courses to find out when our next course starts. And now, lean back and be inspired. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this Never Done Before experiment. We learned that we could live stream through LinkedIn. And apparently, it's more difficult than expected. So we are very happy that we can have you here now as a live audience. Exactly. And it still doesn't work, although I have just updated all the things. So I would say, shall we start? Welcome, everyone. We can just link again in the comments. It is there. So during our last live, we had the word of facipulation coming up. And we're doing all these lives because we're preparing a course, Leadership Through Facilitation, where we are looking at the leadership skills and the leadership role of facilitators, even if they are independent facilitators. And suddenly we're speaking about the role of manipulation in facilitation. And the term facipulation, for those who haven't heard it yet, is the mix between facilitation and manipulation. So today we are coming together with this beautiful panel to discuss, are facilitators manipulators? And to what extent is it ethically correct? Is it maybe even important for the process to facilitate, to manipulate the group? And if you would like to join from the audience, please feel free to use the chat or to put up your electronic hand. And I maybe can do a round of introductions. In the panel, we have Florentin Bersteg and we have Kate Schawinski. And so Florentin is joining us from Porto. Kate is joining us from Berlin. We have Shamir Joseph joining us from Mumbai. We have Thomas Lahnthaler joining us from Norway. My name is Miriam Hapnos and I'm joining today from Australia. Thomas, are facilitators manipulators? Yes or no, and why?
Yes, we are manipulators, I think, because my interpretation of manipulation might be a more positive one than the common one, which is handling something with skills and care. I first, when I hear manipulation, think of orthopedic surgeons that put my shoulder back into place, which is also called manipulation. So I think we're manipulators because we have an influence over a lot of things. Whether this is always used for good, I think we'll get there during this conversation.
Kate, how about you?
Yes. Yes, I do. And I mean, I think Thomas pretty much summed it up very well. We use tools, we manipulate tools, right? And in my experience, we manipulate processes in order to reach an end and to influence. So, yes.
So I hear manipulating processes, manipulating tools, and influencing people. Flora, are we also manipulating people? Where's the difference?
I think so. In the way that, for me, if I, and I try not to do this too much in my facilitation, like if I compare it to how, for instance, we work as parents or caretakers with kids, there is a sort of a manipulation for the good of the kids sometimes. And I'm going to give an example before people call child services. I don't ask my five-year-old, do you want to brush your teeth? I ask her, which toothbrush would you like to use, the blue one or the pink one? And so I am giving her the choice and saying, you're empowered to make a choice, but the fact that you're going to brush your teeth is going to. So this is a form of manipulation that comes from sort of the good of her teeth. And again, I don't like always to make the comparison between facilitation and parenting, but there is something about taking care of a bigger good that sometimes you as the group facilitator will see, and that the group being either very close to content or with a different agendas and hidden agendas might not see. And it's your task to sort of keep people on track. And with that in mind, I think it's a good manipulation. I do see, however, that some facilitators manipulate out of an anxiety or pressure that they feel to reach certain outcomes, or they'll try to cut corners, or they'll ignore voices. And that is a kind of manipulation. So my question to all these things is, to what end do we use the manipulation?
Shami, I see you nodding. What is your take on that?
I think very, very similar in terms of, yes, I think we have the power to manipulate. The challenge comes, what are we doing with it? Why are we going with the purpose behind it? Because that's where I think of how it can be misused. And I struggle with the no part of it. And that's where the ethics of why are we doing this? But then also, who are we manipulating it for? Is it for the group and the benefit of the group, or the benefit of the person who's paying our bill, which might not be the group, might be the client who's paying us? And to what extent does that serve the project's needs? There are times when sometimes we need to move fast, and the meeting or the session that's there tends to be more or less of getting group wisdom, but more of informing people, which isn't really what your facilitation is. But people still employ facilitators for that.
Mm.
And on the other end, you have a group process that needs to be created, alignment that needs to be brought in. So that's a lot of facilitating part of it. So it's really context. And to what extent, and this is where I struggle with it, and how do we choose to into that? Because when you think about big change movements, there are certain changes that happened very directly. And there are certain that change by movement, which means involving people, bringing that consensus, which takes a slower part for you. So are we then manipulating people this way or not? So I think there's going to be an interesting conversation at the very least. So I'm excited for.
And what comes to my mind when just listening to what you said is the role of purpose, and why it's so important to start with purpose. Because so whom are we manipulating for, or what are we manipulating for? And I actually love the toothpaste example. And I think every time that we are designing a process for a group with a purpose and a goal in mind, we are by definition manipulating the group, because we are guiding them a certain direction. And I think for me, it is ethically okay unless we are manipulating them to come to a specific outcome. And that's where facilitation comes in, where we use our facilitation skills to get them to a specific outcome. But I think as long as we remain neutral to the outcome so that the group can own it, we are by definition using manipulation.
Miriam, sometimes I get challenged with the word neutral. Can you tell me more about what you might mean in this context by it?
Thank you for asking. For me, neutral is not that we don't have an opinion. I think, especially facilitators, I think it's similar to teachers. We are very opinionated people in general. Sorry, maybe it's just me. So I don't think that we can be neutral regarding the content or the topic, even the argument, because we are human. But I think as a facilitator, we have to be neutral in the sense of not attached to a specific outcome. Because I think otherwise we don't need a facilitated process. Anyway, so if it's clear to what outcome we are coming, what we are reaching, then we don't need the facilitated process. And for me, that's where neutrality comes in.
Yeah.
And I think that. Also, everybody at the same time, go ahead. You said a lot of good things.
I take it then, because I wanted to refer to a comment that Sage just posted, because it was very similar to what I was about to say. So one of my pillars is emergence, right? So I really do believe that, yes, the client tells us what the purpose of a certain workshop should be, but it's hardly ever the purpose in my experience, unless we kind of stick to what is pre-given. And in that sense, I think it's more about, like, for me, just I actually take it a step lower and not even go to the outcome of the workshop when I think of manipulation. It's more like every design of an agenda is a manipulation, because you're basically creating an artificial process. You're creating something that you think might work for a certain group. So it's a little bit like if you put your head to, okay, how I'm going to start, how I'm going to put the chairs, how am I going to greet them. These are all, for me, in a way, tools of manipulation, because you artificially create an interaction that might work or it might not work because you, based on your experience. But I think it's really these small little tricks. And I often think about magicians, right? I like to work with deception. And everybody thinks, oh, deception is such a bad thing. But then everybody loves magicians because they're so good at it. So it's really playing with what's in the room and give them space to kind of let's play it out, to really, on the one hand, maybe just make their own mental models explicit, right? That's a form of manipulation. But again, it brings us back to the intent, brings us back to, okay, is this really in coming from a good place? Or is it coming from the place of, okay, I'm just going to make this a playing ground here? Because then we enter in an ethical gray zone in a way, right? So... Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I like that choice of intent and play, because the intent informs how we're playing in that room. And that would mean, are we giving more power to certain people in the room, certain ideas that are being shared because they align with what we think the solution should be, even though we're not saying solution, but we're choosing to give time to that, or we're choosing to, on the flip side, because we recognize that that has had a lot of time in the room with that particular idea, but there is another perspective that might not have been, we're then choosing to give power as facilitator to those voices in the room. And say, hey, how about let's think of a different, let's flip this around and then see what happens, because that's part of the process. Now, in our process, we might have said this might take us only 5 minutes and the others might take 10, but we merge into what happens in the workshop, we realize it's taking us longer. In that moment, we're making those choices. We're making those choices that manipulate with the situation that's coming there, but then it aligns to our intent. And then that's where that very thin line between manipulation and what makes it good, what makes it bad. That's very hard to do, because we have opinions as people and we might choose to listen to a little bit more. Sometimes just even unintentionally, just because you're so excited about it, because it's something we connect with personally. So we have to be aware of ourselves, presence, and how it affects that as well.
And for me, what's also important is we come into the space and we design an agenda because we want a transformation to happen. So we want participants to think, feel, or experience something that they haven't before. And I think we can manipulate them into this transformation, into this shift, but we cannot define or manipulate what will happen and what the new perspective will be. And I think that's important. Because there's also, I think as facilitators, the next small step or the dangerous step is to become something like a cult leader. I often speak to podcast guests about Tony Robbins, who is a master facilitator. And he's so good that it has sometimes the annotation of a cult leader.
This is sticking with this example. This is also... This is interesting because I think it fits very well to Zoe's comment on the side here, where she asks about the consent. Now, I think with Tony Robbins, when you look, you see very clearly how he, if you know these tools and techniques, you know very clearly how he applies them. And then the consent bit is a different story, right? And I think what at least from my practice, what I like to do is I like to actually, I don't assume that they come in and trust me and give me the consent to lead them through this, the time's up. So I try to get this consent somehow in the beginning, and I illustrate how I work and see the reactions to it. And if the reactions don't match with what I hope they will, then I will have to adjust how I work with the group, because then I haven't been given the trust or the permission for the approach that I chose initially. So, and that brings us back to the agenda, right? The agenda is our idea. It's our assumption. Often some, like for example, Miriam, and I think also some others here, you have conversations before. I usually don't do that. So I usually don't meet the participants before. So for me, this is a pure assumption on how this could go about. But that's also makes it a very loose paper, right? So in that sense, gives a lot of flexibility to follow and really see how do I actually get that permission to work with you, and in which way can this process be developed and designed, still staying within the field of manipulation, to the sense that I will use tools, I will use processes, I will use techniques that I learn, apply, or come up with on the spot, and that still technically falls under manipulation.
I think Carla asked a really nice question here, that especially for somebody who walks the thin line of manipulation and maybe what we call facilitation or using for evil. I've definitely had moments where I've forced outcomes as a facilitator. And what has happened, Carla, to your question, how do you continue change after the workshop? One of the things that I think is an outcome that you will see happen if you have forced either something to emerge or you force the specific outcome, is that the change after the workshop will be not as impactful or as long lasting as you had initially hoped than if you let things manifest itself, right? If you want to use manifestation and manipulation in that way together. I think for me, what works really well is that measure that you mentioned, like the continuation of change after a workshop. I know that if I forced it, the change will be much less impactful and it will be less sustainable because the voices, the critical voices might not have been heard because I didn't allow it in my process because I didn't like it at the moment, or I had time pressure, or it was too complicated to address in the room. So I would sort of like skip around that and say, you know what, maybe you can leave it on a post-it in a parking lot, and it became this enormous thing afterwards. So that's the kind of, I think, facilitation that we're talking about when it doesn't serve the group, either through time pressure, client pressure, and then exactly like you said, the change afterwards is not sustainable.
It almost feels as if, so we are preparing the agenda for the group. So we own the agenda in the beginning, and then we pass over ownership of the results to the group. And I think if they don't feel the ownership for the results, then the impact of the workshop won't be sustainable. So then it doesn't mean anything to manipulate or to force some outcome on the group. So they need to own it. And I think that's also why it's important that we are neutral towards the outcomes, because it won't do any change otherwise. Yeah.
Some of the spaces that I operate, I'm often jumping into teams to help them realize the value of the design thinking process for what they're doing. So that often means the first part is they're experiencing it, but they're literally going through the process. They are being, you can say to some extent, being manipulated to their ideas, to collaborate, to build things which they've never done, to hear different points of views, which normally not have, or sometimes have the boss outside of the room, right? The hippo outside the room. Because these are things that help collaboration, that help the design thinking process. And how do we continue that after it is, you know, they see the results of it afterwards and they're like, hey, why can't we work like this every day? Then that's the element of, you know, revealing the curtain, what's behind, revealing that process. So then they have group ownership of what happened in the room. Yes, those ideas, but also ownership and enthusiasm to have more of that. And then that revealing of the curtain helps them understand the process of it, which buys into them building and working on it on their own to bring out that change after the workshop. So that element of also revealing, because now we are saying, we're helping them see what has happened, but then understand it and also be empowered to do it. And this comes in my particular context, because I jump in as a facilitator, not just to help the teams with that, but also to help enable teams. So that's why that element of reveal is important for at least my context of work. I just thought, yeah.
I would like to now build the bridge between manipulation, facilitation, and leadership. And I would like to hear from all of you whether you see the same and whether we can play with it. Because so in the course that we have designed, we start with purpose, and we talked a little bit about purpose, that that's where it needs to start, because then the manipulative process runs from there. And then comes presence. So the presence of the facilitator in front of the group in order to have this power, maybe, or the trust of the group to manipulate, then leads to the participants, the people in the space who are manipulated. How do they react to the process that we are designing to them? Which then becomes a power game. So how do the different power structures, power dynamics play in the space when we come with our process and the facilitation? And then obviously the work happens, the process. And how does play then come into the space, which are the six modules of our leadership course?
Yeah, I just want to highlight one thing as you were mentioning this, like, because you mentioned the people element, right? Which is the people we work with, and you said the people who will be manipulated. I'm also wondering sometimes, like, how much our participants or people in the room actually are also manipulating the process in a way, right? And how we can actually support them to do that in a healthy way instead of in a sort of more, I wouldn't say destructive way, but where we start calling people difficult participants. Are these the participants who are manipulating outcomes, agendas, hidden agendas, power relationships? So how do we, when we're facilitating, deal with manipulation from others as well? I think that's something where we're going to see that a little bit in the, not only in the people model, also in the power model. How do we play with that, being the owners of the process, but not necessarily of the outcomes?
I love that. And I would be curious what the other think of participants manipulating the process.
I think that's where presence really comes in, right? Not just presence of the facilitator, but presence of who do we choose to give voice to? Are we saying we hear from different voices in the room, maybe who haven't had a chance to speak yet, helping people to maybe step forward, step back. So if you're a person who generally tends to speak up first, take a step back. So when do we bring in or reiterate these ground rules or these rooms for the room because we are seeing it, or we're seeing participants show up and try to manipulate? So I think it's a bit of the presence, but then also what process, if just the way of sharing that we've decided in the process is through audio, people who are extroverts tend to win. But if we say, hey, let's write down our ideas and share them just by reading it, passing around, building on them before we even speak, and the voice is not the only medium, and that can maybe break down some of the power in the room. So these things, we're really playing around with them as we see it.
I think that's really a crucial point, because what is also tricky is that sometimes I've observed this both as a co-facilitator and as a participant, is sometimes we're also forcing participants to speak by putting them on the spot with a good intention of giving them the word. It's a bit of a gray zone, because we underestimate how much power we have and how much power comes with the actions we're doing. So I think it's what you said in the end is absolutely crucial, that we just mix it up, right? That we're not thinking, okay, just what, there's one solution to this particular problem, but we might just look around. And with difficult participants, the interesting thing is always that they're not difficult. They're not always difficult for the sake of manipulating the process, but there is often something that's hidden behind their behavior. That's the one side to it. And the other side is that not seldom we perceive them as difficult because something is triggered within us. So projecting that on the group is also a bit of a gray zone and might lead us into what probably is labeled facilitation. I actually have to admit, I didn't know that word until a few days ago, so I had to really read myself up. I was very, very interesting and intrigued by it. But it's this whole, yeah, we behave out of our own triggers or our own needs and become manipulators in as a protector of the group that might actually not need that protection.
What's on my mind is, you read my mind, Miriam, about talking about manipulation, leadership, facilitation, and also my mind was on coaching, which is sometimes a role that manipulators, oh God, facilitators might step into.
It's happening.
And so to build on what Thomas just said, it's this self-awareness that leaders have to have in order, and we all, I think it's well established since the last slide that we think facilitators are leaders. And without that level of self-awareness, then it's very difficult, because to lead teams to their utmost capabilities, to their utmost performance, because inevitably you get in your own way, you get in their way. And so this also comes back to something in my mind about psychological safety, how leaders cultivate it, how we model it, and then absolutely how facilitators create this kind of atmosphere in order. And part of that is to acknowledge that there are different styles of participation, to have the belief that having everybody have a chance in whatever way they need in order to contribute will lead to the better outcomes that we're there to achieve. So this to me is an important part about our role as leaders, the self-awareness that it takes not to fall into manipulation, and then how that, yeah, leads to effective facilitation.
Yeah, the open space rule comes to my mind listening to you, that everyone who is in the space are the right people. And also Carla put an interesting comment in the chat. What is the role, or what is the intent of the participants? And I wonder, so I'm not a specialist in systemic coaching or family organizational systems, but I sometimes wonder whether participants in their sometimes extreme behavior fulfilling a role in the system of a workshop, where if everyone agrees, it is important to have someone who pokes this balance and harmony. And if everyone is too quiet, then there is maybe a vacuum, and then someone is taking more space. And I wonder to what extent these, what we sometimes call difficult personalities, yeah, they are only difficult in the perception of others. So nobody is intrinsically difficult. It's us and our perception who makes them difficult, but maybe they're playing a very particular role. And maybe under other circumstances, they show a different behavior.
I think it just, again, comes a lot down to the space. And that's what I was thinking about, these manipulative participants, if we call it that, right? How we can facilitate that manipulation to serve the group. So maybe exactly like you don't want everybody to agree, but you also don't want people to secretly manipulate the group. So you want these people to share their hidden agendas, to share their concerns, and not jeopardize process in a sort of in an out, you know, lashing out way or making random comments. You know, if you have a person who has a negative perspective on the process and it's not, that's not going to work, or constant, like everything that comes up will be, that's a way to manipulate, but there is a need behind that, or there is actually maybe even a point of view that's fundamental to hear in order to make a sustainable outcome or to manifest what needs to manifest. So I think as facilitators, we also need to be aware of how those manipulations can be put to good use instead of being these sort of underground, unspoken needs, exactly like what Carla mentioned as well.
Thank you. Yeah, the transparency bit, I think, is maybe the most important. So opening our agendas, because the moment where we are doing the secrets in secret, then it becomes facilitation. But if we are transparent about our intentions and why we're doing things, we can be very open about our manipulative processes. And I like what Zoe writes, that that's where play becomes important, because through play, we disarm the child. And we often disarm also the participants who, let's say, they need a little bit more attention than others. And that's when we call them difficult.
I want to give a different experience on the agenda transparency, as you might have already guessed.
Why are you surprised?
I don't share my agendas. At least I don't share it in a way that anybody can understand what we're going to do. And this is very deliberate, because my experience has many times actually shown that if they're very familiar with concepts that might come up, whether it's just, you know, this is a block about problem solving, or this is a block about communication, or whatever random blocks there are that they can relate to, the chance of them falling into their roles is higher than if they do not know what's happening and maybe just get a cryptic thing like, okay, into the clouds or whatever other title it has. Because I do think, Miriam, what you said before is crucial, that belonging is a part of it, and we all play roles. And if that role is, and sometimes we, I don't know about you, but sometimes I'm informed about these roles beforehand by the client. Oh, this person is very difficult, and this person is very smart, and you have to talk to that person and whatnot. And that's becoming very clear that these are also the roles that make them belong into that particular setting. So naturally, they will fall into that, because that's A, expected, and B, it's also what they kind of, how they belong and who they are in this particular group. And I think when we create an environment which is unfamiliar, the chances of them not falling into that role might be higher, or we actually might at least give them a bridge to walk over and say, like, now you can be somebody else. And I've made very good experiences with that, because they're just letting go. Of course, there's always resistance, and there's always some people who don't like it. But at the end, I usually get always good feedback, because they're like, yeah, I hated it in the beginning, but at the end, it just really made me lower my shoulders.
I think it's that balance, how I see it, is that balance of giving them enough of information that they are willing to accept to jump in, not enough that they then start thinking of, oh, I know this already. And the way I use this is, as you all know, I'm very playful in the facilitation work that I do, bringing in music, bringing in activities, and I call it being playful with purpose. And I tell them at the start, because it's going to get silly. And for example, is we are talking to business people, instead of telling them, think like a child, I say think like aliens. But I still tell them at the start, we're being playful with purpose. So there's a reason behind that. And then often after that, the play is gone. We're going through it, but we understand, okay, this was the power of bringing in play. Now, where can we bring more of this intentionally? So that breaks down the perceptions of play, to see the value of it. But at the start, not enough information that they're able to then, you know, understand what's happening, but just enough that they're willing to at least take that leap of faith. Mm. Or when we are jumping into it, they're being like, oh, there's something going on. I don't know, but maybe he's got something on his head. We'll see that later, or whatever that is.
And I, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to point out, just to put the, like, name it, withholding information is one of the oldest manipulation tricks there is. So there you go. We use it to great effect.
And I wonder whether, Thomas, you made the experience with it, because I can feel how this can be liberating for participants not to be labeled as the difficult one, although they're playing this role in the organization, especially when the clients start pointing it out. But then can it also be restrictive for some, that some participants are actually finding safety and security in being in that role and knowing that this is what they are playing? And then you come in and you shake the system. So how can you keep it safe for those who need the role and the box as a safe?
I think it only works if you shake all of them or none. So it doesn't really work to just shake a few, because then you basically, you keep the stability in one part of the system, and then you have these wild cards flying around that are completely disconnected. That, in my experience, is not. So that's why I, for example, also have the approach that, so when we talk about psychological safety, which I then have a question for you, which I'm curious what you think about. But before that, when we talk about that, even if you're disruptive, which I like to be, it concerns all people, because if all of them make the same experience, it's a connector. It's not a divider, right? Because it kind of connects them through the collective experience. They were all uncomfortable, so they have all experienced this. And it's that's just something I have learned from my crisis experience. But a question for you. So when we talk about the manipulation, right? And we talk about negative behaviors, such as, for example, lying, right? So what if it helps us to fake psychological safety in order to establish it? Is that so? Basically, just, I read this article a couple of days ago about how leaders sometimes pretend psychological safety through their communication, etc. But what if we, in a more positive way, apply that with the intent to actually make a group feel safer than what the actual psychological safety is? Because the reason why I'm asking this, and then I shut up, is because I think we underestimate that sometimes we are not feeling safe as facilitators coming into a group. I mean, we're not connected to anybody sometimes, and yet we want to kind of facilitate that psychological safety can emerge within that group. So is this facilitation? Is it not? Is it, yeah, where are we? Anyway, that's it for me.
Two things come to my mind. One is, and I love this, thank you. One is, I believe that we cannot create psychological safety for others if we don't feel safe. Because that's the moment where we snap at people when they ask questions. If I feel like an imposter, I feel that, oh, nobody wants me here, nobody respects me, then everyone who says something, I will feel as a threat. And I think that's unconscious. So I think as a facilitator, the first thing is to create psychological safety for ourselves. And then to the second point, I don't believe that we can fake psychological safety. I think that is something so intrinsic and sensory that either you feel it or you don't, but you cannot tell someone to feel psychologically safe. And I get the cringes if I walk into a room, virtual or physical, and someone tells me, this is a safe space. I'm like, who are you to tell me how I feel? Right? It's your job to make it safe for me, but it's not your job to tell me that it's safe. Maybe I'm a little bit too emotional or passionate about this topic.
I'm very much in line with you. And again, to your question, Thomas, and your example, even if you would manage to fake psychological safety in order to create psychological safety, again, there is this good intention behind it, right? There is this clear working from an intention for the good of the group behind it, that you're using, whether it's play, whether it's little tricks, whether it's moments of silence, whether it's withholding information, but it's for the good of the group. And I think where the line for me is very, very thin, actually much thinner than I think we underestimate that a little bit, is when we, because of anxiety or our own lack of safety or the pressure from the client, the time, we start making adjustments to the group, to the agenda, that manipulate the outcome towards less emergence, less manifestation, and more sort of like clear cut. I think that's a little bit what for me is at least this fine balance. So because the example you gave is still coming from a space where emergence will be possible, that there are different moments, I think, that we do things that are manipulative with intention, and then there are things we do them out of sort of like almost a fear reaction from ourselves, or as I mentioned before, participants do it out of their own fear as well. So that's a little bit that balance, I think.
This is what you were discussing about when we were thinking about the course, about how important coaching is. Because of that self-awareness that we need to find about our insecurities, self-awareness that we need to find about our insecurities, not only as the work that we do, but in this space, new space that we're in, but an imposter syndrome that we might be feeling in this new space or this new work that we're doing. Because if we're able to understand it, then maybe when those reactions come in, we won't jump in and try to fill in the answers. We won't jump in and react in a way that dampens what is trying to be emerged. And we can actually be present and be able to lead the group where it needs to go. I think that's where where self-awareness and that's why the coaching element is so crucial to us understanding ourselves. But then how does ourselves affect everyone else in the room and the work that needs to be done?
And we have 15 minutes left, and there were a few comments in the chat. Maybe we can come back to some of them. And one is maybe now out of context, but I think always an interesting question to ask. How is it different for internal or external facilitators? So creating the safety, manipulating the group, disrupting the space, shaking personalities and their labels up. Where do you see the difference between an internal facilitator and an independent external one?
Well, my short answer to that is yes, because as an internal one, you're part of the system. It's the same as when I read, I have a similar allergic reaction that you have to what you said before to that sentence. If someone makes, this is a safe space. I have the same when I hear that managers are supposed to resolve conflicts. It's an illusion and will always be because they're part of the conflict system, and the same as for facilitators. If we're internally in a system, we're part of that system. So you have already connections, you have relationships, there's perceptions about you, which might make it more difficult to come from a unique angle, new angle, unusual angle, because there's probably more expectations attached. And I sadly had this experience last year, the two different sides. Maybe it was just my experience, but anyway.
And then there's the flavor of internal facilitation that isn't necessarily the role taken on by a facilitator, but by somebody who is a leader. So that could be somebody who doesn't necessarily have institutional authority. So we spent a long time thinking about people who are in roles like project managers or product managers. This is a completely different game because, of course, you actually are accountable very much for the outcome. And you have, you no doubt have very strong opinions about what the right thing is. And so that puts even more emphasis on this idea of, okay, maybe you should get an external facilitator if you can bring yourself to let go of that power, right? Because that is a very, very difficult line to walk.
And also the fact that you have to walk back into the organization as part of the system the next day after the workshop. So there's a higher responsibility also in the outcomes. And I think that's also why we decided very consciously to have separate courses for independent facilitators as opposed to process managers, because the power dynamics are very different. And hence the interaction with the participants and the clients and the purpose inherently different between independent facilitators and process managers.
Yeah. I was just reminded of the fact that in this case, I've very rarely been haven't been an external facilitator. But sometimes when I'm for specific organizations that I have a longer contract or work longer with, I'm very stubborn to say, no, don't worry, I can facilitate that. We don't need an external facilitator. When I'm actually always the one who says, you need to get an external facilitator because then you're but when it's myself. So I think, again, there's so much to say about like just knowing yourself and knowing that you will have a different invested interest and just being conscious that. And I think that's also where we as facilitators need to learn to be a bit vulnerable. And I also hope, for instance, that our course can be that space where people can reflect and say, I really messed that up. I wasn't really sure. I have this fear. So that these things like this sort of negative manipulation, forcing your outcomes, if you are an internal facilitator or invested in a process, that you can say that out loud instead of saying, no, everything is under control. I got it. Don't worry. So I really hope as well that we can create that space of reflection. And I think that's also one of the things we want to address in the course, right? Really this mindset and what goes through our head and this self-talk that we have as facilitators.
Yeah. And practically, what do we do with that? So Flor and I are co-designing the process module. And one spoiler alert, one of the things we're going to talk about is when you do have this level of self-awareness, how can you actually design with it, around it, to put some controls on it? Dare I say, that's a very powerful word. But yeah, these are the types of things that we want people to walk away with so that they have a greater level of confidence. And also, I mean, getting back to it, the original point, actually to have, you know, impact that lasts.
Which is leadership. We're slowly, quickly coming to an end. So I would like to have time for three things, actually. A, sharing what is the course about, when to start, where to sign up, having the audience, and we do have a live audience. Yay. Thank you for staying with us. And adding to the conversation in the chat, if you would like to share something to give you the opportunity, you may, but you don't have to. And then a closing round with our takeaways. So step by step. The course, I put the link in the chat. We kick it off on February 1st. It is a leadership through facilitation course with over 7 weeks, 6 modules plus a practice session where we can put things into action. We start with purpose, presence, people, power, process, play, and then we practice. And all of that through the lens of leadership. And it's a course designed for independent facilitators who really want to embrace their leadership skills without facilitating the groups. It's 3 hours per week. We start at 6 p.m. CET, and there's the option to join also a weekly Q&A session, which is basically a group coaching where we go through the different questions by the participants. And there's the option to also sign up for weekly one-on-one coaching. So this means it will be a 30-minute coaching with each of us 6 trainers of the course. And I think honestly, what the best part of the course is, very personally, I'm very biased, is that it's a facilitation course hosted, designed by 6 facilitators from very different areas of the world, of life and expertise. And it's the first cohort. So benefit from it as long as it's small. And if our audience has questions or comments, now would be perfect moment.
Another great facilitation manipulation tactic.
Do mind think alike. Yes, silence as a facilitation tool. And how to show permission through silence. Check out. What are you taking away from this conversation?
To us, Miriam, or the crowd?
I ask you. And Molly answered self-awareness as a facilitator.
Exactly.
Thank you, Molly.
Also for the crowd, yeah. I think I'm going to join Molly in this, talking to you all about this today. I think it's, for me, shown again the importance of self-awareness of ourselves as facilitators. And with that also comes the confidence to hold the space to for others to be self-aware when they're potentially manipulating or don't have needs expressed. And although I'm definitely, like Thomas, I'm definitely an emergent facilitator. I've really enjoyed that. I also know that I'm not always capable of holding that space due to participants or my own anxiety. So just that self-awareness and how you can hold that space better and being conscious of it, I think it's a really important lesson to take away from this.
We have to have more of these honest conversations because I have the feeling sometimes in our world we're shying away from the hard stuff. And so I appreciate the exchange. I appreciate all the comments and questions. And I do also take with me impatience for this to start because I think we can dive a lot deeper into some of these things.
I think for me, it's that exploration of that thin line and how context can shift it, but then also understanding where do we sit with ourselves, that self-awareness as we're going through the process. And it's what I'm excited about because once we've spoken about it, once we talk about it, it's in our heads. Next time we experience it, you know, be aware of it and be like, hey, maybe I need to think about this, what you're doing, and you learn and grow from it. So I'm excited for that part coming up ahead from this conversation.
And one, I'm taking away gratitude for everybody who showed up and came and commented, thank you. And two, yeah, I've had some thinking to do about my own biases about this and assumptions that I make about my intentions and my authenticity, how I show up with regard to this. So thanks.
Yeah, for me, it's similar. I wasn't aware of the thin line and the mix up between manipulation, leadership and facilitation and how it's actually a beautiful dance. We don't want to step on each other's toes, because otherwise it whisked the safe space for sure, and we cannot force it. And I really enjoyed this conversation, also to have an active audience. So thank you very much, everyone. We hope to see you at our course that starts on February 1st. Thank you so much for joining us. And hopefully we got some of the brain cells moving when it comes to leadership, manipulation, and facilitation. Thank you. Thank you for staying tuned and for listening until the very end. I hope that you found the inspiration and the wisdom that you are looking for. And I hope that you will subscribe to the show so that you never miss any of the interviews with another inspiring facilitator from across the world. I'm devoted to continue this podcast and to deliver weekly an episode that maintains the quality that you expect and you deserve. And if you would like to help me to maintain this quality and to keep the podcast free, please help us. Visit workshops.org/support to make a small donation to keep the podcast free. Thank you so much. I hope to be in your ears next week.